Welcome to Editing Aloud, and I have with me, as usual, a team of South Africa's best and best informed journalists. This week we've had more detail emerging on the activities of global management consultancy McKinsey, which seems to have had fingers in many pies, not only taking Eskom for 1.1 billion rand in just 6 months, but also doing lots of work for Transnet at very vast prices, and getting its fingers into the Department of Cooperative Government, local government. Sikonati, your cover story for the Financial Mail this week is genie out of the bottle, how McKinsey and Trillion milked billions from South Africa Incorporated. Run us through the gory details.
I can tell you it's a great story. Look, Stefan Hofstadter went all the way back and found the person that had sold a company called Trillion. To Salim Essa, and he didn't know who the buyer was, but it was just some BEE entity buying the stock. In that year, in 2012, Trillion had a revenue of 2.7 million rand, and it made profit of 440,000 rands for that year. Essa bought it 60% of the shares, and the others were held by staff and other managers like Eric Wood, and boom, 800 million rands within 6 months was revenue they built only from Eskom and indeed from Transnet. Together with McKinsey, they built 2.4 billion rand in 1 year from both Transnet and Eskom, and to do that they found a way, or Eskom and indeed Transnet found a way to kick out a company called Litsima Holdings that was started by Isaac Shongwe, who was at that time a director of Barloworld. They kicked them out of the locomotives tender at Transnet, saying there's a conflict of interest, and they inserted Regiments, but then at that point Regiments as well was morphing into Trillion, because Lita Nyonya and the other guys at Regiments were not very compliant, and they were not letting in the Guptas, so to speak.
So this is now Trillion, which is a Gupta company,
yep,
working with Eskom as working with McKinsey as McKinsey's partner in crime, if you like.
Absolutely.
To take all these enormous contracts. Tim, what would global management consultancies do for 2.1 billion?
No, it's incredible. I mean, if you were, somebody did the math somewhere. I mean, they were earning 50 million rand a day. I mean, it was like the size of the contract alone tells you that this was a fraudulent deal, because there's no management consultancy on the planet that charges that kind of rate, that can charge that kind of rate. Normally consultancies, the consultancies will try and pitch the idea of taking a proportion of what they managed to save the organization. And normally companies try and counter argue against it, and rather argue for
per hourly fee
per number of people who are going to work on the contract. And that's because, essentially if you are running the company, the management decisions are yours, so you shouldn't be paying somebody else to take the kind of management decisions. You should rather be paying them. But there's no number of people, and there's no amount that you're paying at an hourly rate that can get you close to the amount of money that they were getting. I mean, to me, the irony of this whole thing was that the contract was obviously engineered by Trillion, who brought McKinsey along for, sort of notional credibility and stuff like that. But McKinsey still got, 70% of the actual money.
McKinsey did the work. What work was done, by the sound of it, McKinsey did. It's not clear what Trillion did at all.
McKinsey needed a PE partner, and somehow, the initial was McKinsey and Regiments had the relationship. And what Eric Wood did, who was at Regiments, formed this Trillion, went into partnership with Trillion, and they got into bed with McKinsey. And I guess Eric Wood, I think in the Regiments group, he was the one working closely with McKinsey. So he knew what McKinsey needed, and he knew the BE's status. So he brought in Trillion alongside, and this is bringing in the Guptas, and became the empowerment partner for McKinsey, and then they ate from the trough. That's how it worked out.
It was Kuben Moodley, who played golf with Salim Essa and Eric Wood, that actually introduced Mackenzie into Transnet with Salim Essa, and then they took a share of that. And when things were not going their way, they went and offered to buy 50% of regiments. This is the Guptas, and they even called them to their
What's disturbing, in a way, I mean, Mackenzie had done work, actual management consulting for Eskom and Transnet before, as far as I know, re-engineering.
Yeah. Yes.
McKinsey's known for that globally. They come in and they and save your organizations.
And these guys were taking a cut
but
in the background.
This turned into a major state capture story where they were like quite serious snouts at the trough. And as it turns out, they were looking for government work with our four-day finance minister now at Cooperative.
They had a secret sheet of 9.4 billion rand that they wanted to extract from Eskom and Transnet, and in the and the minister and his new advisors, that also came from Trillion and regiments, went there with a spreadsheet of projects they were going to approve.
Mackenzie were brilliant.
And they were going to divide, and they were going to divide the money like they did with Trillion and Mackenzie, and Trillion brought all the political deals, the connection, and everything, and Mackenzie came and did the work. Now I shall tell you in business day soon. I've got the actual contract now between Mackenzie and Eskom, and we're gonna see. I've never seen a contract as vague as that one. I repeat, it's between Mackenzie and with Eskom. There's absolutely no Trillion there, but there's a letter at Trillion where Eric Wood says, "But we know, you know what our understanding is between Eskom and Mackenzie, and that understanding is never put in writing."
I don't know, like, I guess what is the whole thing is a Trillion bringing all this, but I think the person we actually must look at is Mackenzie. Was they brought in Trillion for the political win, right? So but they've been central to South Africa's procurement programs, and the big spenders have been Transnet, Eskom, and at the center of it, advising what to spend on, what to do, has been Mackenzie. And at some point, they played the political game, and Mackenzie's head guy, one guy's lost his job, but I've got his name from Mackenzie. He decided that, look, this is the only way to do business in South Africa right now, and then, and hence the creation of Trillion through Eric Wood, the regiments, why they, but at the center of it all is Mackenzie. As much
Ron,
as we talk
Ron,
about
Ron, this is actually so what I wanted what I want to know. Okay, so one guy's lost his job, big deal,
big
in
deal.
A global consultancy that did 2 billion at least that we know about, and there's presumably more. So now, why has Mackenzie not been the target of public anger, of outrage from the clients, of outrage from the public, in the way that KPMG has been, and before that Bell Pottinger was? Why has Mackenzie really got away with this pretty well
so far? One thing KPMG has is that there's a presence. We know the building, you see that building, so there's something to rally against, right? Mackenzie's always been the shadow. Everyone knows this consultancy, everyone kind of knows, but it's a very highbrow in the shadow type of thing. I think their biggest fear is the US courts, and that's where is that Corruption Watch has gone open a case there. I think that is where Mackenzie is most fearful of having a kickback there, because it's always operated in the shadow. We always know of this Mackenzie and the Bay, and Mackenzie, that's how I guess it escaped it.
Sika, do you think we should be sort of setting the lynch mob on Mackenzie as the lynch mob has gone for
KPMG? It's actually a bit
KPMG.
Too early to say they have escaped. It was Bell Pottinger first, now KPMG. Next, we are going for Mackenzie, and definitely those people that do business with KPMG and with all of them. It's too early to say they have escaped. They still need to answer the question. I asked them yesterday, I had quite a nice conversation on email with Mackenzie. What exactly did you do at Eskom to get that money? You're going to read all about it in Business Day soon.
Thank you, Sika. But Tim, now, surely there is a real concern now about the sort of mounting outrage at KPMG and what that could mean for the audit profession, especially given that KPMG hasn't done enough, which it's admitted, but it has gone pretty far. I mean, to fire your entire top leadership and bring in a new chief exec who's not even an auditor, and sort of really embarrass yourself in public and institute an independent inquiry globally. Why is there not a concern that the sort of outrage at KPMG is going too far, and that the firm may go under?
Well, I think there is, you know, I mean, you're talking about kind of contingency risk in the same way that you were talking, that you talk about it in a sort of general way about banks. But the difference, the big difference is that, you know, There's contingency risk with banks because they borrow from each other and they lend. They're all part of the institution. If one falls, then you know drags all of the others down. The same kind of relationship sort of exists with auditors, but not to the same extent. So you know the only example that we've got was Arthur Andersen. When Arthur Andersen collapsed, actually the auditing profession wasn't as a whole wasn't affected. Arthur Andersen was incorporated, strangely enough, into KPMG, and you know the because really the you know the auditors, you know, in a sense they're like lawyers. They are, you know, operating their own clients and their own accounts. You know that they are you know the overall brand is useful, but the actual work is done by you know in teams. I mean the you know I do feel a bit for KPMG now because. You know, I think they have gone quite far. I mean, if you compare what they've done compared to what McKinsey have done, and how much money they got, and how much money McKinsey got, I mean, it's just black and white. You know, there's totally two different situations. McKinsey got billion. KPMG's you know total audit fees for the 10 years or whatever it was, you know, it was in the hundreds of millions. It wasn't anything like the profitability and the and as you say, they've made a real effort. You know, they've sort of cleaned out the entire top management. The problem is that they're in a sort of legal and reputational bind. Because now, if you are sitting in a company that has KPMG as the auditor, you know, what incentive is there for you to say, let's keep them on? You know, there's no incentive. You know, the smart choice is just say, oh, let's choose somebody else.
Ron, you know, I mean, the implications for the profession are quite profound. I think as Loazi Bohm from Deloitte has said, and former finance minister Trevor Manuel said, nobody is celebrating this in the audit profession, and it's got a real issue which this has highlighted. And at the same time, we've had the World Economic Forum rankings on South Africa really plummeting, in part because auditing perceptions have plummeted. Yeah. I mean, what needs to be done to rebuild the trust in the profession?
KPMG, I would agree with Tim, has done quite a lot to try and rebuild itself, but I mean, it's a long road to come. The key thing for, I guess, KPMG really needs, and I guess that's why the Reserve Bank came out and saying this, is for the big banks not to dump them. And from there, start a slow rebuild of that reputation. But if anything of that happens, if one of the big banks leaves them, then I don't know. I mean, we're stuck with three big auditing firms in the country and the smaller ones, which actually, at the moment, can't absorb the amount of work that KPMG would do. So that will leave the profession itself in quite a sticky point. KPMG, it's still going to unfold over the coming months and into next year, but it's quite
I think there was a call for KPMG International to move in and take charge and give the quality assurance that clients are looking for. And we're going to come back to these and other issues after the break. South Africa has a new licensed bank for, I think, the first time in 18 years. Time, which was granted its banking license the other day by the Reserve Bank, which has brought competition into the banking sector. Ron, is this the sign of things to come? Are we opening up the sector?
Finally. I guess in the retail banking footprint, this is exciting times, right? Looking at Time, it was going to be in 800 pick and pay stores. They have about 350 staff. So it's quite and compare that to a Nedbank with how many 38,000 odd staff and how many branches they have. It's quite an interesting time. Time, actually, it's a nice name for it. And Patrice Motsepe behind it. So they have some guy with deep pockets behind it. So it's quite an interesting time. There's talk of, at some point, Telkom getting a banking license. Or there was talk of them being interested
in Discovery.
Discovery and so on. So this is
a third one. Oh, the post office.
The post office as well. So you can imagine banking costs now becoming an issue. I'm just trying to imagine if you are competing with a Discovery bank that has maybe one or two branches and has this host of clients, what are their costs of making a Ryan compared to, say, a standard bank? So it's going to be interesting what happens for the big banks on their retail side. The one thing I know we never talk about is, like, maybe the investment banking, the investment part of banking then becomes, for the big four anyway, a more important crutch in their business, because is there for taking, and retail goes to every time we can just prove that they have some banking capabilities and get a license, and then that'll, I mean, that changes the whole banking on its head, in the truth.
Siko, are you moving your bank account to Time?
Not yet, but I'm moving it away from Standard Bank though, because of KPMG. Time is a great intervention. It's going to take it from where Capitec started lowering bank fees. And indeed, you go on Sunday now to a shopping mall on a Saturday afternoon at 5 p.m. You see even NetBank open, Standard Bank open. That's all because of Capitec. Now Time is coming in, minus all the cost of the branches and things. Yeah, then you go to Pick and Pay, you pay next to nothing. So great. I'm opening perhaps for my children's bank accounts there, but I'm moving my bank account from Standard Bank because they refuse to dump KPMG. And they in fact tell me that let's give KPMG Time. And I'm not giving them Time. They're not stealing a cent more of my money with my permission. Oh.
And but at the same time, I mean, at least you have a bank, and so do we all. Now, the Guptas are very close to not having a bank, and they seem, according to Business Day Today, to have lost their payment provider as well. So how is this family and their business interests going to operate at all?
Well, do we care? <Fair
enough.
laughs> No, I mean, you know, this is the risk that you run if your business model is
if you
to launder model, that you know nobody wants to wants to finance I think people are looking at this, you know, they're sort of like saying, shame, the poor Guptas, they can't pay, you know. I mean, this is what happens, this is the consequence, you know. Theoretically, they can use pay agents. I mean, nobody's had to before in this, you know, way. They sort of, you know, pop up organizations in some senses, and that's one of the things that, you know, we discovered was that these are not well established, you know, institutions, because no one's needed them before.
This is a very effective way, in a way, of sanctioning private sector people who do wrong. We've so far had no sanction for any public sector people in Eskom or Transnet or anywhere else that have done wrong. Is there any sign that with this unfolding in terms of Trillion and Eskom and the Guptas and KPMG, is there any sign of any action by the sort of underlying cause of all of, in other words, the Guptas and their friends in very high places?
Oh, right? Nothing. Well, politically, we know they're very protected. But my interesting thing about the Guptas thing, you know, this banking issue happened, was it late last year when the banks started squeezing on them? But where are the 7,500 employees, like, so we can visibly see what's just caught into them? It kind of strikes me as, where's the strikes and so on to show that the Guptas can't pay? Or are they paying anyone? Are they paying 7,500 odd people? So it's quite interesting to see how this unfolds.
I don't quite believe this 7,500
anymore. This way we should be seeing some hurts on the streets, right? We should see Kosato marching.
But Sikonati, going back to one of their favorite clients and capturees, Eskom. You've written a column this week about the most useless chief executive.
Yes, there's a guy there. His name is Johnny Lala. He's acting chief executive officer. He replaced another acting chief executive officer who had replaced an acting chief executive officer.
Stage of actress,
So he's the seventh CEO of Eskom since March 2014, but he's absolutely the most useless chief executive officer. They might as well put like an empty chair there or his jacket, it might do as much better than he does. He came in, Eskom had done all these investigations. Of course, when they become inconvenient, they all get dropped. But there's sufficient evidence in the investigation they have done to prosecute at least five people. They have been forced by Business Day now to suspend them. The guys that did the McKinsey Trillion deal, including Anuj Singh and Marcella Coco and Prish Govender. And the chief executive keeps making every possible excuse, hot and cold, why they should not act. He's there 110 days now, and he's done absolutely nothing to fix Eskom. And I'm talking about Johnny Dladla.
Yes. I agree with Sicko, but you know the problem is that he's not alone. You know, his argument is, if I understand it correctly, tell me if I'm wrong, that you know they've done the initial investigation, but in order to do a formal investigation, they need the stamp of approval from the politicians, and they don't get the stamp of approval from the politicians, so they can't do anything. As you would, if by the way, if you were a private sector organization, you would, and you had sort of like an errant division or something like that, you would go to the board and say, you know, you board, what do we do?
Yeah.
You know, and the board would declare what
Eskom has done, has paid millions of rand of our money, and it's coming back to ask for more money from us in the form of a 20% increase. They've paid Bowmans, they've paid Dentons, they've paid Cliff Decker, they've paid Nkonki and Saluba. All of these have produced evidence and said, that guy, cancel those contracts, get the money back. They've done absolutely nothing. And these are matters that fall directly under Johnny Dladla's competence.
However, on Dladla, I'm not defending Dladla because I don't know him. He's like number seven in
That's
in
the
three
problem.
Years,
if
right?
you knew him, you
but
would not
as,
be saying.
As Tim is saying, so the investigations come to the board, he was sanctioned, whatever. But at some point, the shareholder, ultimately, right. one shareholder, goes ahead with whatever must happen beyond that. Right?
There's something called the delegation of authority. Yeah. This falls squarely under him.
But
I'm only talking about those
I'm
things.
Not defending, but
he's
acting CEO.
Exactly. That's the low hanging fruit.
What does he have?
Yes. That's Tim, the low hanging fruit. That
like
should that's the low hanging fruit. If Johnny was
comes with particular things, maybe like
that's the low hanging fruit that an
acting
means. But you know, surely, but wrong. Just to, and usually I'm going to take a second side here. In normal circumstances, the things would be referred to the board and stuff. But surely this is so egregious that you take action.
It's the low-hanging fruit that any incoming executive should be doing, like boom, boom, boom. Out you go.
It's the low-hanging fruit that the minister should be doing.
No,
right?
No, the minister does not run the executive. These
but we know
things
that
fall
you know
squarely.
How this thing flows. That's exactly
what makes him the
that's
worst,
the
most useless chief executive officer that has ever. I mean, even Machela Koko was useful. He promoted 40 women in one day in the 3 days that he was acting chief executive. Johnny Dladla has done absolutely nothing. There's all the evidence before him. All the investigation Eskom has already paid for. He's just sitting there twiddling his thumbs and following Lynn Brown around.
Anyway,
the state-owned enterprises are an absolutely endless source of controversy on this program. And Tim, I'm now going to move to one we don't discuss very often, which is the Roads Agency, the National Roads Agency, which seems to be running its own version of black economic empowerment, which is not consistent with what's been imposed on the construction industry by another government department. Tim, what's the story?
Yeah, here? No. I thought that was a very interesting story because, you know, basically what's happened is that, there was that construction, settlement,
yes.
And you know, there was long discussions about it. They spent years within the minister and the people from the industry got together and they hammered things out and they discussed things and then boom, they came up with a plan. You know,
for the construction industry,
mm-hmm. Right? Then SANRAL. You know, comes up with a different plan. You know,
they build toll roads.
Yeah, so in order to build a toll road, all of a sudden now you have to tick a whole bunch of boxes. You have to be a level two B player. You have to blah blah blah. It's almost as though there's two problems here. The first problem is, and you know, we've seen this before with Eskom imposing its own black empowerment deal. You know, on its clients or its suppliers. You know, which is contrary to the government deal. You know, the situation is becoming more and more confused. You know, there's an official, you know, black empowerment position, and then there's people within the organizations who say, no, that's not enough. We've got to go further. And, you know, all of a sudden, the problem is that, you know, for the construction industry, they've now spent an enormous amount of time striking this deal, and now they're still going to be excluded from, the existing construction place. They're still going to be excluded from building roads. And there are apparently, you know, thousands of tenders that's you know, that can't be filled because there's no one actually to fill them. You know, in this, so in a sense, what that does is it creates the conditions where, you know, sort of fly by night companies get the tenders, then they go to their original you know, take a cut, and then they go to the original, you know, construction company to originally do the work. You know, it's
another trillion McKinsey story.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's how the stuff filters in, because everybody wants black empowerment to work. Everybody wants to do black empowerment, but it's very difficult to distinguish a true black empowerment deal from, you know, a skimming deal, which is dressed up as a black empowerment deal. You know, and you know, they should be much more aware of, you know, the difference between the two. And
Ron, the sort of clashing policies on BEE coming out of government.
I mean,
what do we do?
This is where our politicians are playing the game. I was thinking what Tim just said. Just summarize. So DTI sets this thing, right? I'm sure DTI was probably
that's the code.
That's the codes and so on. And then you have a Ministry of Transport who looks after, I suspect, Sunrail.
Yeah.
So he will want to create his own policy framework and get his own black investors into maybe Sunrail, whatever roads they build. And through them, perhaps the whole plan is then he gets his own, creates his own champions within his own fort, right? His own sphere of influence, get his own black players in there who are kind of, in truth, beholden to him. So, so in essence, maybe this is how it's all played. So DTI will set it up, which is kind of like a SACP minister in Rob Davies, which everyone kind of ignores, doesn't have much political capital. And in your own ministry, you create your own sphere of influence. And I guess getting in black investors is where you influence the money flow, right? And where the money goes within your sphere of influence. And then
but
ultimately become your supporters your future political ambitions.
I understand what the kind of politics of work. I'm sure that's how the politics are. But the problem is, and no one's building the roads.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Look,
I mean, somebody's going to build the damn roads.
Built, and the country continues to just melt. Like, backlog just carries on to build, and we in suffer from it.
Yeah.
But it is ministers and politicians creating their own fiefdoms, which is what has been the past 10 years of ANC government, right? Where, I mean, no one's knowing what the left and the right hand is doing, and that has been the way Zuma has run this cabinet.
Precisely,
for the past
10 years, I mean,
right?
That's the big problem. The big problem is that what you need here is you need a powerful political leader who sorts out this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who ensures that everybody you know, sort of toes the line and everybody follows
and
the.
This is how we move forward.
So you know, so now we're sitting with a kind of like, you know, floating president who's you know, visiting Zimbabwe and doing other important things. You know, and not sort of concentrating on the, you know, the detail of what's happening on the ground.
Never has concentrated on.
That's all we have time for now. Please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud.